All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Thank you, Arizona. Thank you, Arizona. I had a great time. I went out there with Lara Bites. We did Tucson on Friday. We did Phoenix on Saturday. And it was great. It was a great time. It's good to be out in the desert. There's something about the Arizona desert. That's the one. The Arizona desert is the desert. That's where those Sequoia, what are they called? Those specific cacti, the classic old westy looking cacti, happen only in Arizona, or unless people drag them illegally out of Arizona to plant in their yards. They only happen there, and there's hundreds of them. And they just they have a very unique look as they ride up the bottom of a hill up towards the edge of these mountains in Arizona. And they're stunning. There's nothing else that looks like it. And the air was clear and the drive was clean, man. How you doing? Everybody okay? Is everyone all right out there? I hadn't been out there in a long time. I could not remember the last time I'd been out in Arizona. I will tell you this. Today on the show, Adrian Belew is here. Adrian Belew is the guitar player. He's singular, a singular sounding guitar player that not everyone is familiar with, but he's the shit. He's amazing. He's otherworldly, almost an alien. Nobody does it like Adrian Belew. Yeah, I mean, I talk to him about as much as I know about. See, I'm not a huge Crimson guy, but I knew enough about a couple of the Adrian Belew records, just barely enough, not to appease the full Crimson nerds, but certainly to give some context. We talked about King Crimson. We talked about Zappa going way back. We talked about Bowie, Talking Heads, Laurie Anderson, Nine Inch Nails, his solo career. I'm a lone rhinoceros. Got a lot of albums out, this guy. Worked with a lot of great people. We were really able to sort of chart the evolution of his sound and who he is as a musician through his history with these amazing geniuses. It was quite a conversation. And he was out earlier this year on his own, and now he's going to be performing with Jerry Harrison from Talking Heads here in LA next week. They're going to do a stuff from the Remain in Light album, which Adrian is on, and sort of defined the sound of, yeah, I'll Be So Bold. But I was first hipped to Adrian Belew by a guy I knew back in the day when I was in high school working at the Posh Bagel across from Yale Park, across from University of New Mexico, 15, 16 years old. There was a record store. This story spreads its wings a lot. There was a record store next door called Budget Tapes and Records, owned by a couple, a biracial couple that enjoyed the club music, the disco music. Didn't like playing anything in the store but R&B and the disco music back in the 80s, 70s actually. And there was a couple of guys that worked there that kind of changed the way I saw music in general, informed me, educated me. A few things happened. They gave me a box of records, promo records that they didn't use. It had Elvis Costello's first record in there, George Thorogood and the Destroyers. It had Tom Waits' Nighthawks at the Diner. That box in and of itself kind of laid down the track, laid down, wired me up, you know, plugged in some stuff. And then there's one dude, what the hell is his name, with the big mustache, who once took me to his house in an innocent way, and we made a mixtape of all his R&B records, the old stuff, Sam and Dave, Otis Redding, Etta James, I think, was on there. What was Solomon Burke? I mean, it was just all of the stuff, the old soul business. What the hell was his name? Why can't I remember? Jim. I think it was Jim. More importantly, Steve Lash LaRue, who was in the great performance art outfit called Jungle Red, who performed once a year in surgical scrubs. But Steve was a guy to hit me to the stuff, man. Brian Eno, The Residents, Fred Frith, John Hassell, you know, the Bowie stuff. I think he was the guy who first turned me on to Adrian Belew. If it weren't for Lash LaRue, Steve LaRue, I wouldn't know about Adrian Belew, and I wouldn't know a lot about his stuff. That Budget Tapes and Records next to the Posh Bagel around the corner from the General Store head shop on Harvard Street across from University of New Mexico completely blew my mind and arranged it back correctly around certain music. Now, Steve was a musician himself and sadly committed suicide a few years ago. And it's one of those situations where a mutual friend, Clemmer, David Clemmer, from he kind of pulled together a bunch of stuff he sent me on CD that I still have to go through of this guy who was kind of a mad oddball genius in his own right. I'd fallen way out of touch with him for a long time, and I just heard about his passing. And Clemmer's got all this stuff, and I got to go through it. But what happens to that stuff? What happens to the unsung wizards of the oddball realm, the musical astronauts who couldn't quite cut it and couldn't quite hack it, ultimately, for whatever reason? Rest in peace, Lash LaRue. Thank you for turning me on to Adrian Belew. And that's that backstory. So I was very excited to talk to Adrian Belew because, man, he makes that guitar sound like nothing else. So my slightly demented father came out to Phoenix to hang out with me, and I was nervous. I didn't know if he would recognize me. I didn't know if we had crossed the line, and he certainly did recognize me, and he was quite happy to see me. We were quite happy to see each other. I tell you, man, we've all done bad shit in our life. We've all made mistakes. We have problems with people we love. But I, you know, seeing my father over these last few years as he enters this end run with this problem, this dementia, has been pretty great and pretty, I'm finding a lot of peace around us, around him, around me, around whatever I remembered him, however I thought he wronged me or however, whatever, man. It just doesn't matter. It's certainly drifting out of his head. That's the gift of it. If there's any way to look at it in a positive way, it's they don't remember. There's no going back to that. So you let go and you accept and you take what you can. Enjoy those moments, man. But like, he was pretty present. He turns on the juice and his brain works a little better when he's around me, his wife said. And I talked to him, got him going about some stuff in the old days. I showed him some x-rays, some pictures I had on my phone, and my mom's got a little issue in her neck, and that used to be a place where he used to do the surgery on. He was orthopedic. I showed him the x-rays and asked what he thought about the problem, and he locked right in, man. He did the doctor thing for a few minutes. It's all sort of still in there, and I'm just saying, man, you know, forgive the people you love, forgive yourself, find some peace. Can you? Can you do it? Look, whatever my issues were with my parents, they're all fading as they fade. And I'm happy to be as present as I can be for where they're at right now. It's a gift. And I did that show in Phoenix to a packed house. And I did those jokes about my dad and his condition with his wife there. And her brother was there and his wife, I think, and their niece and my old man. And I pointed it. I did that. I made fun of my dad in a relatively good-hearted way. And I thanked Rosie, his wife, for taking care of him. And I introduced them to the audience. And it was kind of beautiful. They had the best time. She was just so grateful and had so many laughs. She loves when I make fun of him. The last time they saw me, she said I didn't do it enough, so I went out of my way. I just punched away at the old man. He loved it, and I'm sure he doesn't remember any of it today. But she will, and she's the one at the front. She's at the front of his battle. So, very grateful for her, and it was a powerful night, man. So look, you guys, I talked to Jerry Harrison. It was a few weeks ago, of Talking Heads. I was corrected on that. We talked about Adrian Belew, and then here he is. Adrian came. He and Jerry are performing songs from Talking Heads' Remain in Light next week at the Wiltern Theater in L.A. You can get tickets at thewiltern.net. And this is me covering the ground with Adrian Belew. Where'd you come from?
Northern Kentucky. I was born in Covington, right across the river, Ohio River, from Cincinnati.
Really? Because it's weird. Like, I've listened to stuff you've played on my whole life, right? Here and there. And I always knew your name. I remember there was a guy I knew who worked at a record store in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where, you know, next door to where I worked in high school at a restaurant. So he turned me on to, it must have been Lone Rhinoceros.
Right.
When did that come out?
That's 82, the first solo record.
Well,
the year after I did the Discipline record with... King Crimson. Yeah.
And I think he gave me that record. It might not have been him, but there was a whole world of music that you were involved with that was like, I thought you were from outer space. I didn't
grow up on the planet Mars, but it's a little small colony that we had there. Yeah.
Just the guitar colony.
Yeah, guitar.
The colony with the amps on Mars.
Amp Mars.
But like, I just never assumed that you were of human upbringing.
Yeah, well, maybe there's something to be said there. I've been watching a lot of Ancient Aliens.
Maybe you did land?
Kentucky itself is a little alien.
Well, what year were you, was there music in the house?
No, no one in my house, no one in my family had any musical background ever anywhere. My father's side of my family were kind of country people.
Yeah.
Minor Kentucky area.
How'd you get rid of your accent?
And traveling the world all my life. And my mother was a Sunday school teacher.
Really?
Yeah, and homemaker.
Yeah.
And there was nobody there.
Brothers, sisters?
Anything. Two brothers younger than me. Neither of them played anything or had any interest. So
yeah.
It just hit me when I was about 10 years old. I said, I want to play drums.
Drums. Yeah.
And we had just moved to a new part of Kentucky, Ludlow, Kentucky, a little further down the river.
Yeah.
A river town.
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, okay, well, we'll have you in the junior high school Ludlow Marching Panthers.
Yeah.
But you have to play trumpet.
Did you learn how to read music then?
No, I didn't. No, I just learned how to do marching cadences. And I said, no, I don't want to play trumpet. I want to be in the drum line.
Yeah.
I didn't even know what it was called.
That's so funny that despite your desire to play an instrument, they're like, well, we need a trumpet.
Yeah.
So like, you're not going to be anything.
Yeah.
Just play the trumpet.
Yeah. We don't want you in the band unless you'll play trumpet. But I threw a proper fit and, you know, they put me on drums.
Yeah.
And for 3 years I did that. Then we moved 10 miles away to Florence, Kentucky.
Away from the river?
Yeah. So everything was gone. I had no friends. I wasn't in the band anymore. And at that time, the Beatles had come out. And when I moved to Florence, Kentucky, before I went to freshman year,
yeah,
I was just in a neighborhood. My new neighborhood didn't know anybody, but there happened to be a lot of musicians there, and we started sort of hanging out.
Really?
And pretty soon they said, well, you got to hear this band called the Denims. They do all the Beatles stuff really great. So I went to see
the
Denims.
Band?
Local band, the
Denims. You how old now?
I'm 72.
No, I mean, how old were you then?
So I was 15.
When the Beatles happened, you were about
14.
15? 14, 15?
Yeah. I was 14, 13, 14, but by the time I got to Florence, I was maybe 14 or 15.
Did it blow your mind, like when the Beatles came out? Was that the thing?
Incredible. Are you kidding? I went upstairs, and I actually had enough hair to cut it into bangs.
You did?
I went right straight to the bathroom, cut my hair into bangs.
But you don't have recollection of like Elvis or any of that generation?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, my mother had a little radio that was built into the headboard of her bed in their apartment. And I remember hearing, "You ain't nothing but a hound," mm-hmm. and running in the bedroom and jumping up and down like a crazed little child at age five to Elvis.
It did.
But Elvis, and there were a lot of other people in between Elvis and the Beatles that I loved. Roy Orbison.
Sure.
The Everly Brothers. The Beach Boys.
Yeah.
The Ventures, you know. But then it was the Beatles.
That's so funny because all of those, that through line, there's a through line to everyone you just said. Like, you didn't go to Jerry Lee Lewis or, you know, Little Richard.
Love those guys too.
But there's this haunting harmony trip that goes through the Ventures
and
Orbison.
Absolutely, it was harmony for me. Because, see, even when I was five, I could sing along with those kind of records and even sing the weirder harmony. So I would sing for my aunts and uncles and stuff, and they'd say, oh, he's so cute, you know. And I thought, well, this is what you want to do for a living, right?
Yeah, that's funny. The Ventures. Did you ever do a surf record?
I've written three surf songs of my own. Now I'm going to do the third one on my next record.
Okay,
but
I was friends.
I am friends with the Ventures. Well, the remaining Ventures have just recently passed.
Just passed? Yeah,
Don.
Yeah,
Don
yeah,
Wilson, yeah. And I was friends with Noki Edwards yeah. as well. I love those guys. Yeah. You know, they were really old school guys, and I would see them at, you know, I'd go to some of their shows and hang out with them, and they accepted me. They loved me. They were like, we don't know what the hell you're doing, Adrian, but we sure do love it.
Wait, were they playing like state fairs and stuff?
When I saw them, it was usually at the NAMM shows. I used to go all the NAMM shows out here in Anaheim every year, and they would almost always be playing somewhere. But I saw them other places too. In fact, my trio opened for them in a festival somewhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, who was? So they finally got to hear me, and they were scratching.
Was that
their heads.
Dick Dale?
Or he's no, different. Dick Dale. He's different.
He was another guy. He was like
the Surf King. He was on his own,
right?
Yeah. But the Ventures really were important to. I wasn't even a guitar player when I heard The Ventures.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even when I heard The Beatles, of course.
Yeah.
When I was 16, I had mononucleosis, couldn't play in the Denims, couldn't play drums anymore in the band.
So you saw the Denims and then you tried to get in the Denims?
They asked me to join them.
To be a drummer?
Singing drummer, yeah. I could sing any part, you know.
And they were primarily...
I could mimic Paul's voice or John's or George or even Ringo. So,
oh, really?
Yes.
They were a cover band primarily?
They were, but, you know, they got so popular in the Northern Kentucky, Cincinnati area that there was a popular DJ. His name was Dusty Rhodes on WSAI radio, and he coined the phrase, Cincinnati's own Beatles. So we were Cincinnati's own Beatles. We had the little... We had eventually had the military suits
so you did
and the
play
Super
with them.
Beetle amps. Yeah, I played with them for 3 or 4 years.
Really?
Yeah.
All through high school?
Yeah, 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 exactly. Until
drums.
A little out of high school. Yes, and when I was 16, I couldn't play with them for 2 months. I had to stay at home with mononucleosis.
Yeah.
While I was there, I had all these songs in my head.
Of your own making?
My own making, and I could hear them like it's a record playing. So I said, can I borrow a guitar? Borrowed a guitar, the father's guitar from one of the guitar players.
In the Denims.
In the Denims.
Yeah.
And I sat at home for 2 months and taught myself to play. I didn't have anybody show me anything. I just figured it out by, okay, I want this note. Where's my finger go for that note? I want a harmony. What finger can go there?
You didn't have a chord chart?
Very painstaking process. But when I came back, you know.
So you had to invent guitar.
I invented my own chords for sure. And when I came back, you know, I had 5 of my songs written and played them for the Denims. And they said, what the hell are those chords?
Really?
Yeah, because they were like my own chord shapes. And I said, I don't know, you know, a furnished flat. I don't know.
And they still don't match up with chords?
I still didn't know chords.
Did they play the songs?
After that. Yes, we did learn one of them.
Yeah.
Just one.
What about the other? Yeah, you still waiting to record those other ones?
We never got to really record and stuff. We didn't get that far down the pike.
So how did your tenure at with the Denims end?
I think something else in the band happened. Someone else left, and we decided to call it quits. But it was at the time that in 1967, and I was graduating from high school. It was at the time that Sgt. Pepper had come out, and we could no longer imitate the Beatles. I mean, it was just that simple. We said, what are we going to do,
Sonic
boys?
Problem.
Hey, lads, what are we going to do? We can't sound like the Beatles anymore.
Oh, because it was out of that sort of basic,
old-style rock and roll. We did try to play, you know, I read the news today, oh boy. But where's the orchestra? Where's, you know, this
sure.
shit? When you get to the big part where the orchestra swells, it's the two guitar players going ning 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 ning.
Yeah.
It just didn't work.
You can't do it.
Nah.
And you can't do it. Well, you like the amount of production that all the sounds that they made with that record. How are you going to do that?
Well, the one preceding is my favorite, which is Revolver. And I remember bringing that. We were playing at a Catholic church gig, and I remember bringing the record to the other guys in the Denims. Go, look, here it is.
Yeah, here it is. I just gotten it. Yeah.
And we were just marveling over the cover and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, as we learned some of those songs, we realized, wow, some of this stuff we're not going to be able to do because, like, you can't do Love You Too, the Indian song. You can't really do...
Without a sitar,
you know?
And
with all the other accoutrements. Or, you know,
but
turn off your mind, relax, and vote downstream. Tomorrow never knows.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean...
That must have blown you. Were you playing guitar full time there,
I was writing songs.
But like that, the sort of strange sounds and the backward looping,
and
just some of the leads on that record must have informed your brain somehow.
Totally.
Because that was the first time I think that's weird guitar playing.
It is. In fact, I remember Also, in the church parking lot, Sarangi, we played a lot of churches at that point, I guess. Hearing on the radio, sitting in someone's car, I didn't have a car, and hearing "I'm Only Sleeping."
Yeah,
that's the first backwards guitar part
I ever heard. Right.
Which actually,
but you didn't know it was backwards, right?
I had no idea what it was, but I knew it must be a guitar.
It seems like he figured out how to play that forwards.
And I totally, well, not at that point. I wasn't that good.
Yeah.
But I totally flipped out over that sound.
Right.
Backwards guitar is still something I use a lot, and now I can hear it live while I'm playing. I can actually play live and make it sound, make it play backwards.
With some of the toys you can
do? Yeah, with a digital delay. It's a technique. It's hard to do because you have to be always playing ahead of where you want it, what you want to be, because it has to record it first and then play it backwards.
Oh, so it's
about a 2 second delay.
Oh, so it actually has to play backwards.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't mock the sound of backwards.
I have a pedal, so I'm playing this pedal, and when I finally push it down, it engages whatever I've been playing, turns it around backwards, and there, poof, voila,
so
there
gotta,
it is.
So you got to play it ahead of it to match it.
2 seconds ahead of it, what you want to do.
So you're,
told you from another planet I am.
But you're pretty. but that's sort of incredible because you're doing that in a live environment, and so your engagement. I mean, you got to have a lot of confidence in your rhythm section and everything else to stay on that.
I make a lot of loops when I'm playing with my own trio, and that's another thing you have to. That has to be perfectly right on. So you're going to step on this thing, boom, right there. And then you're going to step on it again to end it, boom, right there. And it's got to be a perfect loop.
Right.
Otherwise, you have to undo it and start all over again, which is highly embarrassing.
Do you have a practice regimen now?
Not at all. I just play a lot.
Okay.
I never have actually had a practice regimen. Even when I was in King Crimson and we had to all that stuff, I would just, you know.
That was Crimson in a nutshell.
Once Robert and I finished our 4 hours of practice every day, I'd slough off, you know, and like, you know, okay, I'll catch up tomorrow on that.
But where does it, like, so how, where do you sort of begin to sort of, you know, bend the possibility? So you go from the Denims to what?
I got in a band.
In Kentucky.
As a guitar player.
In Kentucky.
Well, it was a Cincinnati band, in fact.
Okay,
from Cincy. A part of Cincinnati.
But not the Cincinnati Beatles.
And they were gone by then.
Yeah.
And I started, you know, well, around that time.
What was that band? What were they called?
The first one was called Gory Oatley.
Yeah.
Isn't that, how's that for a name, huh?
And this is what, 69?
Probably 68 or 69,
yeah.
Yes. And Jimi Hendrix and Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton had arrived on the scene.
Yeah.
And so at that point, I was saying, gee, I want to do that stuff, not just be a guitar player. So I was learning, oh, Foxy Lady.
Right. Just by ear.
Yeah.
And I played
the record and just figured it all out. And I figured out everything Hendrix did as well as I could. And also Jeff, I loved his playing a lot.
Well, I mean, Hendrix trying to, you know, Billy Gibbons tells a story about opening for Hendrix in Texas. And Hendrix had a full stereo console set up in his hotel room. And he basically said to Billy, he said, let's go try to figure out what Jeff Beck is doing. And that was Hendrix. So Hendrix was
I've got to tell Jeff that one. He probably already knows it.
It was baffled by Beck.
Oh, my God. Beck was such a lyrically beautiful guitar. Still is. He's my buddy and my favorite now.
Really?
I mean, well, you know, Jimi Hendrix did something no one else will ever accomplish. He opened all those doors and he was unique unto himself. At the same time, however, I always felt, well, Jeff Beck was doing some great stuff too. And Jeff has been there since. So if you look at his entire career, Jeff has done more than Jimmy has by now.
Well, right. But you also, like, the sensibility around electronics was different.
Yeah.
You know, like, it felt like, you know, despite whatever Hendrix did, he was still, you know, in some sort of loop with those amps and still in the blues in a way.
Yeah.
But it seemed like his pedal game, was, and people know this, I'm not that deep a nerd, was minimal.
It was,
right?
Yeah.
And, but Beck would, like, right, even on that, like, on the on I Ain't Superstitious with Jeff Beck Group.
Yeah.
Like that sound was something, you know, was beyond anything that anyone could
recognize. Unbelievable, really. It was a wah-wah with some wonderful room delay on it.
And, is that what it was?
Uh-huh. And he just was so great with it, though.
It's brain changer, that was the beginning.
He always did. I mean, right from the beginning, for me, when I was still in the Denims and wasn't playing guitar, the Yardbirds had on one of the Yardbirds hits, they had a flip side, which turns out to be an old Les Paul track, renamed Jeff's Boogie. And that track right there, from there on, I was like, I love this guy named Jeff Beck, whoever that guy is, you know, that's incredible.
Yeah, and then
now
he did
friends with him.
You are? You guys pretty good buddies?
Well, we see each other whenever I can.
Well, there must be, like, there at some point, as a guitar player, are in that ether. Well, I believe.
One time I was in London in a little club. This was back in the day of early King Crimson.
Yeah.
And I was standing on a balcony and I was looking down at the band. I don't know what band it was. I just wanted something to do in a night out. And across the way on the balcony, I saw Jeff Beck.
Yeah.
And I looked at him and he looked at me and we both sort of started walking to the corner. We met at the corner and he goes, "Hey, you're that elephant guy." And I said, "Hey, you're Jeff Beck." And we just kind of hugged and said, "Yeah, this is great."
he knew. He was on it.
Plus, when I did later, many years later, my favorite compliment happened, which was with Jeff also.
Elephant was in referral to?
Well, he had seen the video of Elephant Talk, I think. Okay, so he knew I was the guy that made that elephant sound stuff. But years later, we were playing, I think, at Royal Albert Hall, once again, King Crimson.
With Crimson.
And the end of the show... I did Three of a Perfect Pair by myself as the first encore.
Yeah,
guitar and voice.
Yeah.
And he just fell out over that. He couldn't believe I could play that and sing that at the same time. So I went backstage, and there he was in the green room, and he came up, and I reached my hand out to shake his hand.
Yeah.
He reached my hand out with his, and with his other hand, he made this motion that he was sawing my hand off. And he said, "You bastard."
Look at that. The competition remains. It's funny. Because when you're an astronaut, you know, and you've already sort of mastered space, right? You're kind of like, you know, who are the other guys out here? You know, and you're the other guy out there.
So I still have a problem even believing any of that or thinking about myself in that way. I just, you know, it's...
You just play? You don't feel competitive?
It's hard to equate yourself to someone that you...
Right, grew
you
up. Know, yeah, loving.
I mean, but I don't get in awe of any of these guys. You know, I spent an hour, as you have, with Paul McCartney, and I just loved it. I loved every minute.
Sure.
Was enjoyed every second of it. He was so wonderful.
Yeah.
But I wasn't sitting around like, oh my God, it's Paul McCartney. I should have.
Yeah.
Because he has also meant an extraordinary amount.
Well, I mean,
to
you
me
can do
life.
That. I mean, I have fanboyed with certain people.
Yeah,
like with Keith Richards. You know, I did.
Yeah,
and but then the second time I interviewed him, I was kind of busting his balls. Once they become humans to you,
and they do quickly,
very quickly.
That's the thing when you meet these people or you work with them. You know, I meet David Bowie, and before I know it, me and David Bowie are joking about stuff, and he's no longer really that David Bowie. He's a different guy to me.
Well, I keep trying to, like, and I think about it with you, and I think about it when I talk to any musician, the sort of magic of the ability to sort of take a stage in front of, you know, tens of thousands of people and do that job and put on the show is kind of fucking amazing.
It is.
I can't. It's still a mystery to me. Like, even talking to you, you know, knowing that you were like on the Remain in Light tour and on all those Bowie, I don't know how many tours you did with him, all the Crimson stuff.
Two Bowie tours.
But, you know, you're here, but, you know, do you feel a shift when you, like, is that zone
magic? Oh, yeah. It's strange. It's something overtakes me. I can even be really sick.
Yeah.
And I can walk on stage and I'm no longer sick. I'm so completely zoned in. And there's an energy force I honestly feel. It's not like a mysterious thing. But from the audience that just completely, all of your adrenaline just goes sky high and you're in the moment and you're playing. And a lot of gigs I play, it's over almost in a flash sometimes.
Really?
You go, wow, that I just barely started and that's done.
Yeah.
Because you're so in the moment.
So, like, okay, so you lock into Beck. I don't hear a lot of Clapton in you.
No, but I learned a lot of his stuff because I did love...
The riffs?
I loved Cream.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and I loved, you know, a lot of his stuff.
Sure.
Jimmy Page, too. Well, yeah. Lesser. Jimmy Page was a little later, Led Zeppelin. I was kind of on my own doing
stuff. You don't strike me as a blues guy.
I did learn a little blues when I was teaching myself.
But you didn't love it, right?
Well, I figured to me that blues is kind of a great way to learn how to play soloing and stuff and show off.
Right. Did you ever listen to Peter Green stuff?
I did.
Yeah.
I love that song, Oh Well, Part 2. Love that song.
Yeah.
So I had my little phase of blues. I was listening to John Mayall and you know.
So it was specifically sort of like, I got to pick up a guitar at a party.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to be able to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I learned how to finger pick like Chet Atkins. I learned a...
Come on.
I did. I learned a few...
How'd you do that?
I just taught myself.
You didn't read nothing? You didn't? You just...
I don't read anything. I mean, in terms of music.
No, but you didn't read anything about how he did it, like the Travis picking? You just kind of figured it out?
No, I figured it out from records. Yeah. Everything I learned when I started, I figured it out from records.
Or did you like...
I seemed to be pretty good at it.
Okay, so you
I had a really good detailed way of doing it, and I would figure out, like Beatles, but the Beatles were my biggest teachers, and I figured out every part.
Yeah.
Bass parts, drum parts, guitar parts. I'd listen to the production.
Would you spend hours?
Oh, my whole life was spent in my parents' basement. At the end of school year, you know, when everybody else had a tan from playing baseball, I'd be the pale guy that went back and still trying to figure out the next guitar riff.
And what was that guitar, that first one that you had?
The first one I had was a Gibson Firebird because I thought it was a pretty interesting looking guitar.
Great guitar, right? Big.
Big and unusual, really.
Yeah.
Something.
They're still kind of unusual.
But, you know, eventually over time, I was working with my friend Seymour Duncan, who became, you know...
You know that guy?
Very well. Back then, we knew each other.
In Kentucky?
Well, he lived in the Cincinnati area, and he was a very good guitar player at that time, too, by the way. Anyway, long story short, I kept talking to Seymour about changing the sound of the Firebird I had, and eventually said, you know what you really want here? You want a Stratocaster. You keep getting me to put Strats and, you know,
because the Firebird had those mini humbuckers, right?
I didn't like the sound of the guitar. I just loved the look of it.
Yeah, sure.
So eventually I got a Stratocaster.
Oh, like in the late 60s?
Right. Around the time I joined Frank's band.
So you're in Cincinnati, Kentucky area. You're playing with Gory whatever.
Yeah, Gory Oatley.
Did you record?
That was only for a year, by the way.
Well, so how do you just like, how does Frank find you?
Well, I went through a lot of things over the next 10 or 12 years. Cover bands, Elvis cover band, every kind of band, Holiday Inn lounge band where I went
until
back to
almost
playing
30?
Drum. Until I was 27 years old and I was sitting there really thinking, oh my gosh, I missed the bus. Because everyone is supposed to be famous by then or not.
And you're doing a hotel lounge gig?
I was in a Holiday Inn lounge band for 2.5 years. It was called Sound Assembly, 2 guitar players and me on drums. We didn't even have a bass player, but we were called Sound Assembly.
Were you miserable?
I was miserable 5 hours a night.
Yeah.
But then I had the rest of the day for a month at a time sitting in a hotel room and a Holiday Inn to hone my art and teach. I taught myself to play cello. I played drums every night. I taught myself to play flute. I wrote a lot of songs with acoustic guitar. I sold my Firebird to get a drum kit to play that gig because there were no shows for me anymore. This was in the disco era.
Wow.
And, you know, all the gigs had kind of dried up, so there was nothing. So I thought, well, I better keep going with my writing at least. And so then what happened, I had a manager, and he called me.
In Kentucky?
You know, in Cincinnati, Ohio. Cincinnati. Stan Hertzman was his name. And Stan couldn't do much for me because there wasn't much going on.
Right.
And I was, you know, light years away from having a record deal of my own or anything. But he said, there's a band in Nashville called Sweetheart.
Yeah.
and they need a new guitar player. Strangely,
Sweetheart.
The guitar player from Gory Oatley had left Sweetheart. Small world.
Full circle.
And so I went down to Nashville, joined Sweetheart, played in that band for about 3 years, one night.
3 years?
Yeah, one night. And then I was 27, and one night we were playing in a dank, dark bar called Fanny's. It was a biker bar. It was actually painted flat black inside, full of bikers. Not a great place, but... And I looked the hallway, you could see who was coming in, and there's Frank Zappa with his crew of people, his big bodyguard, John Smothers, and Terry Bozzio, the drummer, and a whole horde of people who looked like Frank Zappa guys.
Yeah.
Came in, he listened 40 minutes.
Just by coincidence, or he'd heard about you?
He'd heard about me from the chauffeur. He played a show that night.
In Nashville.
And he had a chauffeur taking him around, and he said, "We want to go see a great rock band. Who do you recommend?" The chauffeur said, "This band." He took him to see Sweetheart. So Frank walks in, he sits there for 40 minutes, and you know, I remember all of a sudden he gets up, he walks up to the stage, reaches up to me. I'm playing Gimme Shelter by the Rolling Stones. He shakes my hand and says, "I'll get your name and number from the chauffeur, and when I'm done touring, I'm going to call you and audition you." And eventually that is what happened, although it was about 6 months later, and by then I thought, well, that was just a dream.
And then you flew out to L.A.?
Yeah, my first time flying ever.
And what guitar did you have, the Strat?
I had a very simple natural wood Strat, which made it through the first 2 months of touring with Frank, and then we took 2 weeks off before we went to Europe, and that guitar never arrived back in Nashville.
Oh, you lost it.
So I lost it, or it was stolen.
So, all right, so you fly out here, you audition for Frank over in Laurel Canyon at the house?
Absolutely, yeah, in the basement.
And how and this is what year? We're talking?
77.
77.
Mm-hmm.
So Frank is deep in Frank.
He's very frank. I'll be frank about it.
Yeah, and that house.
He didn't get more frank than that.
So you go down in the basement.
Yeah,
and what do you got to do for Frank? What's the setup?
Okay, so his basement was not yet the gorgeous studio would become years later. It was a linoleum floor, and it was full of different activity.
Uh-huh.
People moving around, you know, pianos and things. It was very distracting.
It was the original basement, and then he built that whole other world.
Oh, yeah. Every year I would go back and see him. Whenever I was in L.A., I'd always go back, and he would always say, welcome to my construction project.
Yeah.
And it was always being... But this time, it was very simple. But there was a lot of people doing things there. And there was a little console. He was sitting behind the console, kind of like we are here.
Yeah.
And I'm standing in the middle of the room with a little pig-nose amp. In my Strat.
Pig nose.
Yeah, a little tiny pig nose amp.
I mean, that's real little for people who aren't guitar people. We're talking at cigar box size.
Yeah, it can't sound like anything.
Did you have batteries in it?
Yeah, it ran on batteries. That's what I could afford, ladies and gentlemen.
Come on.
And Frank would say, okay, play, you know, he'd take a puff off a cigar. I'd go, okay, Adrian, play Andy. And I'd start playing for about 2 minutes or whatever, and he'd stop me. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Then he'd start on the next one. He'd give me 12 songs to learn. And when I talked to him on the phone, when he called me, he said, "You do read music?" I said, "No, I don't. I'm totally autodidact, self-taught."
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, okay, I'm going to give you a shot. I never do this, but I'm going to give you a shot anyway. I like the way you were singing and playing, so let's see what works."
Yeah.
So I go there, and we go through this 12 songs in no time.
They're all Zappa songs?
Oh, of course, yeah. And we're from different records. I had to borrow the records from friends of mine. Long story short is I failed miserably, but I was so distracted.
Really?
I had nowhere to go, so I stayed around and watched other people do it.
Well, how'd you fail? What do you mean? He didn't want you to be in the band?
No, I just knew that I just didn't do well. I was too nervous, and there was too many distractions.
I thought he said he was going to give you a shot.
He did give me. That was my shot. So I was standing around there because they said, okay, you're just going to stay here till 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. Then we're going to take you back to the airport, ship you back home to Nashville. So I had nowhere to go. And I watched some other auditions, were hair-raising auditions, you know, keyboard players. And I watched a percussion audition. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, at the end of the day, that was just me and Frank standing there next to each other all of a sudden. And I looked up and said, "Frank, I'm really sorry. I know I didn't do well in the audition, but I thought it would be different." And he said, "How so?" And I said, "Well, I thought it would be just you and me quietly, and I could just show you that I can do this." And he said, "Well, great. Let's go upstairs." So we went upstairs. I took my pig nose. I turned it as far up, all the way up, pushed it down into the cushions between on his purple couch.
Yeah.
We sat there, we did it again, and we started again. And about a third of the way through, he started singing along with me, and I knew, okay, this is going well. And then he stopped and put his hand out. This is typically Frank, shook his hand, okay, you got the gig, here's how much I pay for this, here's what we do if we do this, here's if we don't work, we get this retainer, and so on. Explained the whole thing to me, and it was done.
And you did like 4 albums?
I'm on, I think, 8 or 9 records because they keep finding things in the vault.
Right.
But the record I did was Chic Your Booty.
The disco record.
Yeah, and Chic Your Booty is, not many people know this, out of all of his records, it's the biggest selling one.
So because it had that
2
hit
million
on there.
Copies.
What was that? What was there was
Bobby
a hit
Brown?
On there.
Maybe Baby Snakes? I don't know. It was one of those things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there was a bunch of really interesting, good songs on there.
Were you a fan of his before?
I only knew...
Wasn't it Dancing Fool? Isn't that what
it is? Dancing Fool is on there. Yes, that's it.
That was a hit.
I'm a dancing fool. Yes, exactly. That's the one. Yeah, I knew some of Frank's work, but not a lot. When I was going back to the Denims when I was 16, the manager we had in the Denims, we always have a manager. And this guy came in one day and said, here, Adrian, I want to give you this record. And he said, you're the only person I know who might really appreciate this. And it was Freak Out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that's early.
And
so that's before...
That was the first double album ever made.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. And when I was... Later on, I would stay at his house most weekends so I could learn...
When you were touring with him?
No, when we were still rehearsing.
Yeah.
We rehearsed for three months. So I could learn the parts ahead of time when everyone on Monday would get, you know, sheet music.
Did you find him difficult to work with?
I found Frank to be perfect for me.
Yeah.
He was very demanding, but he was also, for me, very generous, friendly,
humorous. Well, you didn't read music, so he had to show you what he wanted.
Yeah. So I hung out with Frank.
Uh-huh.
The other guys in the band, bless them, they're all great guys, they were all L.A. guys, so they went their way after every rehearsal.
Who was in the band at that time?
Terry Bozzio, Patrick O'Hearn, Tommy Mars, Ed Mann, Peter Wolf. That might be it. And so, you know, they would go home. I would go home with Frank.
Because he needs some place to stay.
Yeah, you know, on the weekends he would show me stuff. And then when we actually went on a tour after 3 months of rehearsal, unbelievable amount of rehearsal, I had learned 5 hours by then.
Yeah.
By rote.
Yeah.
And I just continued to hang out with him. It would be me, him, his bodyguard, John Smothers, and our road manager, Phil Kaufman, who would go to breakfast together every morning or be seated on a plane together. So I got to be friends with him, you know? I would watch him write music on a plane.
He's a funny, intense
bring out
guy.
These great...
Right?
He was so fun and so great to me.
Yeah.
But he did have this one thing.
Yeah.
To be in Frank's band, he demanded you just be super professional. You know, no drugs, no hangover for the next day, none of that. You play things consistently and correctly. That's what he preached. And I needed that. I needed that kind of mentorship, so it was perfect
discipline.
For me.
The
now,
discipline.
After that, I went right into David Bowie's band, and it was completely the opposite. David,
you could do it.
But David said, I want you to go crazy on guitar, just go wild.
That was for the Berlin records, and that was sort of like
Lodger,
He was. I love Lodger.
I do too.
I think it's one of the, is that all you?
Yeah.
That thing is it's one of these records where I'm like, how is that not the best, the favorite David Bowie record?
I can tell you how. Because RCA was dropping him on that record. It was the last of his deal with RCA, so they did not promote it at all.
And that was that the last of the Berlin records?
That was the last of the Berlin. That was the last of the Berlin trilogy.
Look back in anger.
Oh, so many great things on there. We had a great time when we did it. That is my first actual recording experience. What I recorded with Frank was all culled from live performances and Baby Snakes, the movie, all those songs on Chic Your Booty. I never got to go in the studio with him, but the first thing I ever did in a studio
was David.
So
that
was all
live? They culled it from live? No shit. So that's a lot of work for somebody.
He recorded everything live, Frank did.
Yeah.
So my first actual time in a studio, Lake Geneva, Switzerland, Tony Visconti's the producer, along with Brian Eno and David Bowie.
Oh, my God.
And it was... pretty amazing.
But Eno fascinates me.
Yeah, he is fascinating.
I mean, like, if you learn discipline and doing your reps from Frank, what do you learn from that crew in Switzerland?
How to do everything a different way, completely thinking out of the box. Not that Frank didn't think out of the box, of course. He naturally
did. It was Frank's box.
It was Frank's. Yeah, it was his box.
Yeah, it's a big box.
I'll give you a huge box, universe of boxes. But I'll give you an example. So this is what happened. You know, we went there, and the studio we were in used to be the place that burnt down. It was a casino that burnt down. It was what they wrote Smoke on the Water about.
Come on.
Yeah, that's the studio. And guess who was playing there when Smoke on the Water, when it burnt down? Frank Zappa. How ironic, right?
Oh, so, Frank Zappa in the mother.
Yeah, that's it. That song.
Yeah.
So when they rebuilt it, they built it into a concrete bunker, literally, totally out of concrete. So the first floor had this, you know, fairly small control room. That's where David and Brian and Tony would be. And then I would walk up these concrete stairs to the room above, and they had a one-way TV camera that could see me.
Yeah.
And so they could talk to me and look at
me. You couldn't see them?
I couldn't see them. So here's Brian's big idea.
Yeah.
First of all, they told me, well, this record is going to be called Planned Accidents.
Yeah.
Planned Accidents.
That's Brian telling you
that. We have 20 songs here, and we want you to just play what comes to your mind. So what we're going to do, we want you to go upstairs, put your headphones on, you'll hear the drummer count off, one, two, three, four, and then start playing.
No key, no nothing.
I said, playing what? Can I hear the song first? Yeah. No, you can't hear the song.
Yeah.
Oh, can you tell me what key it's in? No, no. So,
come on.
So,
really?
So all those songs, Red Sails, I'm a DJ, Boys Keep Swinging,
I am a DJ,
all those guitar romps that are in there, those were me playing initially whatever I could think of to play throughout a song I'd never heard before.
But you're not hearing anything coming into your cans?
No, I heard the song, but I had no idea.
Okay,
I mean, it would go to, I wouldn't know the first thing about it.
Okay.
There's a chorus coming up, I wouldn't know. So they'd let me do that maybe twice through.
Yeah.
And then I'd start maybe the third time, and they'd say, wait, sounds like you know where the chorus is. Forget it. We're done.
No shit.
You're done with that, yeah. And then and then what they would do is they would do a composite track of their favorite bits from that, and that's why those guitar things are so outrageous. But, you know, later I had to relearn them and play them myself anyway. And there was another story connected with that. So one day I come down from the control room, and I go in the studio.
Yeah.
Control room, and they're laughing together, and I say, what's so funny? And they say, well, we got to tell you something, you know, we did this with Robert, and we made sure, we thought that these parts were impossible to play, but no one told you, you're so stupid you figured out how to play them. Because I had just been playing all that stuff on tour with David.
Yeah. So whose idea was all that? That was Eno?
That was Eno, yeah, I'm sure. But David probably agreed with it, too.
And you toured with David?
Then I toured with David for 78 and
with
70,
Pedro too?
79. Carlos.
Carlos, Carlos Almodovar.
Carlos was the, he was the band
name?
Leader.
Almodovar? What's his last name?
Carlos Alomar. Carlos, he was the band leader, and he had been with David and played songs like Fame, co-wrote some stuff with him.
He's a good player.
Yeah, he's good, yeah. So that was, you know, who was in that band, and then it was down to me to try to do all the stuff that was on those records, and it was a lot of fun. Now, the next time I did was 1990. David came back to me and said, I want you to be the music director of this much larger tour we're going to do, 108 shows.
Which one was that one?
27 countries, Sound and Vision.
Oh, yeah.
And so you can bring your own band, and I want you to figure out the arrangements and do all that stuff. So that was a whole new level for me of touring.
You had to put together a band?
Well, I had a band already that
your
we
guys.
Were touring at that time,
what
a trio.
Yeah, okay.
Backing my record called Mr. Music Head.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a keyboard player and a drummer. I would say just that. We didn't have a bass player either.
Yeah.
Because the keyboard player would play keyboard bass.
Sure.
So all David wanted to do was insert a bass player he liked from Switzerland, and away we went. We had a small little band playing all of his 35 or 40 hits.
Wow.
Because he advertised it as being the last time I'm ever going to play these songs live. So we went around the world, 27 countries, and played everything. And how we did it is we had samplers that the keyboard player would trigger.
Yeah.
So the orchestra would come in for, you know, Space Oddity, and
sure,
we'd be, you know, we'd sound like the record, but it would only be four of us. And on top of that, the show had big, huge opera scrims and videos and stuff. Very, very amazing show. And they put the rest of the band, the other guys, three guys in the band, behind an opera scrim in the back of the stage. Huge 60 by 60 foot stage that they carried everywhere.
Yeah.
And only I was on stage with David.
Wow.
Just me and him.
Wow.
Which was scary as heck.
Well, you do some stage antics.
I did then. Yeah. We even have a runway we had to go on, you know.
So,
and it was fun.
You go from there to Crimson? Or no? Or the Heads?
Talking Heads next. Next up, folks, is Talking Heads, yeah. They saw me at Madison Square Garden with David, and then I came to a couple of their shows when they were out on tour, and then finally they asked me to sit in and play Psycho Killer, and then the next thing I know, they asked me to play on Remain in Light.
Yeah, see, like, that record is, for a lot of Heads people, the record. And in terms of, like, that's their peak to some people.
To me,
and
too.
It is.
I just say, you know, for me it was.
And a lot of it, a lot of people,
I liked a lot of their stuff, but
a lot of people attribute it to you. So when you say that's the peak for them in your eyes too, what makes you say that? Why?
I just think it's a record unlike any other record.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just the Heads too. I mean, it's Brian Eno, and it's, you know, it's a package of ideas and a new way to make records.
Yeah.
That no one had attempted yet at that point.
Which was how?
Layering everything.
Okay. Well, that's an Eno thing, right?
So, you know, you would, I would say, let's say, I wasn't there for the whole thing.
It's almost like looping with a pedal.
It is.
Okay.
It's looping, and then what it is everything is on a track, and then if you want that loop to come up, you turn that track on, then when you want it to go away, you turn it off. So you're continually building these different combinations of the loops that you have.
Sure.
And so everything, when I went there, there was nothing but the bass and drums and a few little of the guitar tracks.
Yeah.
Just a da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- there in the control room, and they say, okay, here's what we want you to do. We want you to go out and in the control room, I could see me, big glass between us. Put your headphones, listen to this song, this da-da-da-da-da. It's not going to change keys, nothing.
Yeah.
There's no vocals, nothing.
Right. Yeah.
And kind of imagine where a solo would be and then play a guitar solo.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. I went out and I stood around tapping my foot. Well, what a nice groovy track this is. Ha, ha, ha. Wonderful. Then I launched into a guitar solo.
And yeah.
And that was the guitar solo for The Great Curve. And so then I thought, well, they were all jumping up and down behind the glass. I could see them just going crazy. So I thought, well, that went pretty well. Let me wait around another couple minutes. I'll do a second one.
And that's how it worked.
And that's how it worked.
And you toured with that.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
Toured the world with that.
And that was a big crew on stage.
Yeah, well, the only way to do that record, because of the way they recorded it, which I just explained, was to bring in a lot of extra people. I was one of them. They had a second bass player. They had a percussionist. They had a second keyboard player.
But that wasn't
so it ended up being a 10-piece band.
But not the same. That wasn't Bernie Worrell. It was,
yeah,
it
Bernie
was.
Worrell.
Okay.
Yeah, Bernie was in the band. He was the keyboard player.
But you Buster weren't in Stop Making Sense, though.
No, this was before Stop Making Sense.
But Bernie was on that, too.
Because what happened for me right after that is Chris and Tina and I went down to the Bahamas to try to make a record together, which became the Tom Club.
Yeah,
and
that's a good record.
Yeah, it is. Great.
Fun.
Genius of Love is still being re-recorded by people.
Yeah.
The last record called Lato that's out right now is Genius of Love being resampled yet again.
That's nice.
I'll be picking up a little check for that.
Do you?
Yeah, of course.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you
and
took off.
And then I joined Ken Crimson.
Okay, but like Catherine Wheel you're on?
Catherine Wheel I did with David, and
I also did two
of Jerry's solo records. So all in all,
did
five records.
You did Jerry first one? Casual Gods? You were in the Casual Gods?
Red and Red and the Black.
Wow, that's crazy.
Those
man.
Five records.
Yeah.
And then I jumped into King Crimson, did Discipline, and then did Lone Rhino. So within like a period
of
just...
So you start, you do Discipline, then you do your first solo record.
Yeah, I was doing it at the same time, really.
What was the shift into Crimson after they'd been established? Was that, did you feel some nerd pressure?
Enormous pressure. Unbelievable pressure. Well, you know, the funny thing was, you know, all my life...
So Discipline, what's that, their fourth record or fifth record?
Oh, I think, I don't know how many records they had before. Probably six, maybe.
Okay.
But it was never an actual band that went from record to record, as
right.
you know. Robert
right.
well, was the only continuing figure from record to record.
Okay, okay.
So then they take a long break. I think they stopped in 73 or 4, come back in 1981,
yeah.
and then it's the new band, me, Tony Levin, Bill Bruford, and Robert.
Right.
And what happened right off the bat was Robert sort of gave me the keys and said, okay, you're going to be the front man. You're going to be the songwriter. You're going to write the melodies. You're going to write the lyrics. And you're going to be my guitar partner. All the things that I had been waiting for to have all my life were suddenly handed to me. But it was actually in a band called King Crimson, which was my second favorite band after the Beatles. So for me, it was huge pressure.
So well,
I didn't even know, well, how am I going to write a song with da 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 da. We rehearsed that stuff over and over, hours a day.
You and Fred.
And I was supposed to then turn it into songs, which was kind of...
So you kind of broke it open with Bowie, and then, you know, you got into a different groove with the Heads, and Zappa gave you the Discipline. So, but you were a Fripp fan from way back.
Yes, I knew King Crimson very well. When I was in the Holiday Inn band, we'd play five sets a night.
Yeah.
I would go back to my room, put on headphones, and put on King Crimson.
Which record?
All of them.
Yeah.
All of those records.
Learning those
I knew,
riffs?
I knew. I never learned any of them. I never even tried to play them.
Oh, you just like to listen to them?
No, I didn't know how they were playing that stuff.
No, I didn't.
I didn't understand odd time signatures or anything then yet. You know, I hadn't played with Frank yet.
Yeah.
That's where I learned that. So I just loved the records, and I thought, wow, this is another level of music here.
Yeah.
And then one day I wake up and I'm in that band, and they're saying, hey, you now it's time for you
to lead the band.
To basically write the songs and anything.
And you're singing them too.
And sing them,
yeah.
And play the dual guitar parts with Robert at the same time.
And
plus, jumping around while you're at it in a pink suit.
So how was your relationship with Fripp?
It was wonderful for a long, long time.
Yeah?
Because he always supported my ideas. I mean, he was very difficult to work with in certain ways. Things had to be his way.
Yeah.
And that was not always, you know, absolutely great. But he gave me, personally, a lot of leeway.
Yeah.
Because he says, you know, whatever you need. If you need this to change to another key, if you want to do something else in here, just take it. Make it yours. So,
yeah.
That's what I had to do. I mean, we started with Frame by Frame, and I right off the bat, I added some chord changes, moved it up a key, and so on, to make it so that my melody would fit.
Yeah.
And then wrote the words, and then we went away. There we go.
And
now
he was
we're
good
starting.
With that.
Yeah,
he was,
absolutely wanted that. So when we get to something like Elephant Talk, I'm just fooling around one day in rehearsal and start playing on guitar, and we start kind of playing along with that. Tony's playing it, and pretty soon it's okay. Well, I think I can make that a song. That's how it was always framed. Can you make this a song, or should this just be an instrumental?
And you did like a million records with them.
Yeah, did a lot. I did 33 years worth of records with them. And I wrote all the songs and lyrics for 33 years.
That's fine.
Every one of them. Yeah.
And are you guys still friends?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, after Robert recently, this is, I guess, 14 years ago, it's not recently.
Yeah.
Decided to go a new way with a different band. I was hurt and, you know, I felt funny about it.
Yeah.
The way he did it was kind of a little cold.
Which band was that?
That was the last one they had, the eight-piece band. He started that eight-piece band.
Okay.
But anyway, I was also, at the same time, very, very engaged in my solo career again.
Yeah, you did so many records.
We hadn't done anything for a while. So I was, you know, and then eventually I did a movie with Pixar, and I invented something called Flux, an app that plays music differently every time you hear it. So I was really engaged with a lot of things, and even if he had asked me to be in the band, I would have probably had to say, I can't do it right now, at least.
Right.
So, you know, I got over it. I said, okay, so it's King Crimson without me. It's okay. I was there for a long time.
You were there I
loved what I did and what we did together, so I'm happy with it.
Well, I mean, I imagine that in terms of, like, you know, Crimson Heads, like those first three that you did, like Discipline, Beat, and Three of a Perfect Pair, I would imagine that for most of them, they're like, those are the records.
Yes, that's what I always hear. Yeah. No, I mean, that's, you know, a lot of people from a different age group in particular who didn't get the first round of King Crimson, the first thing they may have gotten was, you know, Elephant Talk or something off of Beat or something. That is King Crimson to them.
Yeah, now,
like the guys in Tool, for example, they tell me that.
Oh,
a lot of people. Claypool told me that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, a lot of other players say, you know, that's
your Crimson,
that's
is
it.
The Crimson.
My Crimson, if you want to call it mine.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't think you can call it mine because it really, truly is Robert's, I suppose.
No, I know, but he put you in charge.
Well, he kind of gave me the keys, and I didn't lose them.
But what was it like when you had to learn all the old Crimson that you never went to, when you sat down with Robert?
Well, we didn't at first want to do any of the old King Crimson. Robert refused to do 21st Century or any of that stuff. But eventually we learned, I think, Lark's Tongue and Red, and that became part of our repertoire.
Was there ever a moment where he like had he showed you something and you're like, oh, okay. Or did you already kind of know it?
No. Only thing that Robert and I worked on was the really tricky interwoven gamelan kind of guitar stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that was his idea, so I had to learn how to do that with him.
Yeah.
And
that must be pretty exciting.
And then I had to learn how to figure out how to write songs with it. That was the real tricky bit for me.
Yeah, but it must have been fun to get into that groove with him.
I loved it. We would sit, you know, for 4 hours a day.
That's
always four
nuts.
Hours.
Yeah.
Unplugged guitars, electric guitars, and sit there and just go da 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 da. It was like exercising or something, you know.
Yeah.
And then it would go, okay, now we're gonna let's change it this way. And it was fascinating. It was wonderful.
It must have
freaked me out for a while because I didn't know how it could possibly be made into songs, but I did it.
It must have been another huge kind of building block of your skill set. I mean, like
definitely. Definitely. I think King Crimson, I look at it now as being, you know, really probably half of my legacy.
Uh-huh.
The other half being 25 solo records.
Yeah.
The other things in between, playing with all the different people, of course, are in there too, but those are not your own makings.
What's your favorite solo record of yours? Like, where do you think you really kind of, just for my own knowledge, so I can go.
You got to hear the last record, Elevator.
Yeah.
I feel like I feel like I've gotten better and better, and that's where I really want people
you
to start
landed?
From.
Yeah.
If someone said, hey, you got 25, where do I start?
Yeah.
I'd say, start with this one. It's the last one, and I feel like it's worthy.
Oh, great.
There are other ones, you know.
Yeah.
I would say it's something like Op Zop Tuwa, Inner Revolution, Mr. Music Head.
Yeah.
And some people, this is what bugs me, some people say, yeah, I got your, you know, Lone Rhino record and your Twang Bar King record, and I love your solo stuff.
Yeah,
and I'm
yeah.
like, well, you're only missing 23 then. It's a lot of music, folks.
Dude, it's hard to keep up, man. You know, I
do understand that. I can't keep up with other people's records now at all.
It's a weird thing, too, and it must be weird for you. You know, when you've been part of some amazing bands, you know, and defining bands, and you defined the sound of some of those bands, that people, like, don't associate you as a solo artist.
Yeah,
so they, you know, early on, you know, when you do the beginning of Crimson, and then you do the first two solo records, the Crimson guys are like, oh, he did a thing. But then, like, eventually they just keep moving forward with Crimson. They don't know what you're out there churning away.
You can't really expect people to keep up with everything. I can't do it myself. Long ago, I actually stopped, Mark, trying to listen to much music of anyone else's because I felt like it dilutes what I'm doing, and I've got constant creativity going on in my brain, honestly.
Yeah.
I've got a studio in my basement of my home.
Where are you
bottom
living
floor.
Now?
I've been living for 30 years in on the northeast side of Nashville in a place called Mount Juliet.
Okay.
And the first thing we did was put in a studio, and it's the best thing I ever did.
I bet.
So
of course
that's
you have
to. That's how I've had the... That's how I've been able to make so many records of my own or with the Bears or even King Crimson records. We did two of those there.
And what's your relationship with Reznor? How did that come about?
Well, my relationship with Trent was always based on, I think, what I did in David Bowie.
Okay.
With David.
Okay.
I think he was such a fan of David. So one day I was in LA doing something else, and I happened to have my gear, and my manager called me from Cincinnati and said, I just got a call from this band, Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, I've heard about them. I don't know anything about them. And he said, well, they want you to play on their record.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I've got my gear here. Maybe I should. He said, I think you really should do this. They sell a lot of records. And
yeah.
But I didn't know their music. So I ended up going and doing that first session for Downward Spiral based on that. And I loved it. I just loved the sounds they were making.
That
Trent's
record.
Trent's sounds and production was so great. And at one point I was crawling around on the back of my gear, plugging things in differently just to find new ways of doing things for him. Because that's basically what he would do. He would always, on all four records I've done with him, he'd say, okay, I've got this. Now listen to it. Now, is there something you could think you could add to that? I go, yeah. I got five things I want to do. Okay, go. And I go in the, I record them, and I come back in, and they're like, oh my God, that was great. Oh, that's fantastic, And then I'll go away, and 3 months later, the record will come out, and I won't recognize what the heck I played because by then they've...
Too many layers?
They've just done so much to it. So that's always been my experience
with
them.
That record's insane. Those two records, well, you were on four, but the Fragile and Downward Spiral,
yeah.
Like, what?
And all of those were done that way where... Never was it planned. Here's what I want you to play.
Well, thank God
you try to play this, or
and you were trained.
Like that.
That's the Berlin system.
Yeah, I always
right?
brought. Yeah, I always brought my game with him. Like whatever, when Trent would call me and say, well, "I'm going to do a new record. Can you come out?" I'd say, "Okay, I got this new thing I'm doing, and I got this new trick, and I'm going to do this."
That's great,
and
man.
I'd always make sure I gave him. I put those on his records.
That's
they
great.
Belong there.
Yeah. And you did this work. I mean, you've done a lot of bits, like, I guess, with Tony Levin. He asked you to, why wouldn't you go play with Tony Levin?
Oh, right? Of course. He's the best. I love Tony.
Yeah.
He is the best. He's phenomenal.
And
as a person, too, by
but,
the
like,
way.
What do you see as just jobs? You know, like, Paul Simon has two albums. Was that just a job?
Well, I love Paul Simon's work.
Sure.
And I think he's fantastic. One of our best songwriters
ever.
But it was kind of that, because...
Yeah.
I was just thrown into it. I wasn't going to be in his band or anything else.
Yeah.
It was kind of that. And Paul is one of the very few people I ever worked with who was very, very specific with what he wanted me to play.
Okay.
So he would say, no, I want you to play this. Da, 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 da. Here's the harmony. Da, da, da. You know? And, and I'd say, okay. But the thing he wanted from me, Laurie Anderson... who I'd also done three records
with. Few records,
with,
right? Yeah, I love those records.
Had talked to Paul and said, if you want to ever have a guitar player who's not a guitar player, you got to hire this guy, Adrian Blue. He does all these sounds. So I brought in my synth stuff, and I was doing guitar synth mostly on that record.
Okay.
Graceland. This is Graceland. Now I walk in.
Hell of a record, man.
Walk in on the first morning, and there's just Roy Haley, his engineer and producer for many years, just there, and me. And Roy said, you want to hear some of the stuff? And he puts on some stuff, and I thought, oh my God, Roy is getting a little senile or something. This is not Paul Simon's records. It was all African stuff.
This isn't
Paul Simon.
Right.
So then Paul arrives, and I said, Paul, I'm having a little trouble. And he goes, oh, well, here, let me show you. He like stands right next to me and starts, put up the Boy in the Bubble song.
Yeah.
He put up that track, and he said, I've got some of the words. He starts singing some of the words in my ear. I'm getting chills down my back, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then I go, of course, that's Paul Simon. How brilliant. You've reinvented yourself, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was so wonderful.
On the back of the sound of the African continent.
Yeah, totally. And he told me the whole story about how he spent 3 years there, studied the music, knew what it was all about, and then took it upon himself to make it his own.
David Byrne did that, too.
Yeah.
With Brazilian music, correct?
Yeah,
really?
I think so. Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't around for that. But so anyway, when I worked with Paul, it really was him... wanting sounds and me providing the sounds. But so when you hear the da 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 horn section, that originally was my synthesizer guitar parts. I had written guitar parts that sounded like a baritone sax synthesizer.
Yeah.
a tenor, alto, and I played the whole horn section. I think they added other horns later.
So this synthesized guitar business, as it evolved out of your original, you know, Jeff Beck seeds,
yeah,
and then you sort of like kind of rest. You, there's literally solos that you do where it sounds like you're wrestling with the fucking guitar.
Well, I usually am, yeah.
and but you know, there's a whole sort of a menu of sounds that you can now make.
Well, I call it my vocabulary.
Yeah.
And it's a go-to thing. So throughout my records, especially my solo records, I've threaded all these themes,
you know,
I've got this sound and I can use that here. I go to it for as orchestration, like a composer might look at the orchestra, say, okay, I know what, if I have these two bassoons, do it this way, I can get this sound.
Right.
That's me. I've got that.
Your vocabulary of sound.
Yeah, but the thing is, I'm always trying to change it.
Yeah, and do you?
I do. I change it all the time because I can't just go back and keep doing the same thing. That's my heart. I'm a creative.
Yeah. So that's exciting. I'm excited.
I can't stop doing that.
Now I've got to get on it and get elevator as soon as you leave and get in it.
I brought it for you.
You did?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Oh, great.
I brought a CD of it.
Oh, that's great.
A couple of them. You can give them to, you can put them in your closet.
No, I'll keep them.
And they have my artwork, so you can see my artwork in your closet.
You don't release on vinyl?
Not yet.
I'm going to be that idiot.
It's too...
Yeah.
It's too, right now, it's just taking forever, and I couldn't wait any longer. I started making Elevator during the COVID lockdown, and it was done 2 years before I could release it.
Right.
So I was saying, I'm not going to wait another year for vinyl.
Sure. No, I want this out now.
I wrote it.
I can get it on Apple Music, right?
Absolutely, yeah, you can get it all over the place.
So the Laurie Anderson record, she must have been just sort of like, go for it.
Absolutely, another one of those. I think after a little bit of time, I think people just came to me with that in mind.
Yeah, because they're like, you were a guy. Yeah, you brought in your bag of tricks.
You're not asking me to come in and play rhythm guitar much.
So how does William Shatner happen?
That was through his producer and player, Ben Folds.
Yeah, oh, okay.
They were in Nashville doing his record.
Yeah.
4 PM, I get a call from Ben. And he says, we're doing a late night session tonight with William Shatner, Henry Rollins, and me. Were you interested? I said, are you kidding? What do I have to do? Well, just bring your stuff over around 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
We went till 5 in the morning. And it was the best session. And all of those guys were just going wild. At 5 in the morning, William and Henry were running around like little kids, riffing off of each other.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And it was just amazing, man. I just had the best time.
Oh, that's fun, man.
So all I did was, you know, hey, can you make up this kind of thing? Sure, okay.
Yeah. And I'm going to watch these guys run around.
I loved it. So fun.
So now playing with Jerry on these gigs, you're going to be here in L.A. at the Wiltern?
Wiltern.
Is... how much prep did you have to do with Jerry? It's just the two of you and a band?
It's a full band.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a 10 or 11-piece band. I mean, it used to be a band called Turquoise.
Oh, yeah. Jerry told me about it. Two of the members left,
and my bass player from my trio, Julie Slick, has now taken the place of the bass player. But we've got a 3-piece horn section, 2 backup girl singers.
It's a big deal.
It's a big deal. We've got at least 3 or 4 keyboards.
You doing most of the singing?
Like 3 or 4 guys who play. We play guitar. We share it because we don't really want to appear to be, I'm trying to be David Byrne.
Right.
So Jerry will do some, I'll do some. The baritone saxophone player, Josh, does some.
But you do a couple of blues songs too, no?
We only do Thelahun Jinjit from King Crimson. I thought that was more appropriate for that band because of the size, and I wanted to use the horn sections and the percussion and stuff.
Yeah.
It really fits that song well. We do a real cool version of it. It's more almost Talking Heads meets King Crimson version.
Oh, wow.
Really, truly.
Oh,
but I sing, I think I sing out of 15 or 16 songs, I think 5. I think.
And Jerry seems great. I had a great time with him.
I love Jerry.
Great guy.
He's great. Jerry has really been helpful in my career a lot of times. He's the one who really got me on Remain in Light and really got me on the tour, Talking Heads tour. And we've kept in touch over the years and seen each other a lot of times.
Yeah.
He produced a record, for example, God Shuffled His Feet, that record, and called me in to play on that song. You know, so we've bounced ideas back.
Whose record was that?
Crash Test Dummies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, big record.
And do you stay in touch with Eno?
A little bit, but I don't really have that kind of relationship where I feel free to just call him with nothing. But I did talk to him a couple of years back, and it was a nice conversation.
Yeah.
We were trying to do something, a technical streaming kind of service thing that fell apart before it even got
started. See, he's another guy who I love, but like at some point it's like, oh my God, he's done 19 records since the last record I bought.
Yeah.
I mean, what am I going to do?
Yeah, you can't keep up with it. I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
His records are great.
Oh, yeah.
Another one I like is is Andy Partridge with XTC. He's another friend of mine. He's just prolific as heck.
Yeah, he's another guy who's mad at me for interviewing Todd Rundgren.
But well, Todd Rundgren, let's talk about Todd.
Yeah. Did you ever work with him?
Yeah, I just did his new solo record. He and I wrote a new song together, co-wrote the song called Puzzle.
When's that coming out?
Is it's it out.
Oh, it is?
It's out. Puzzle. You got to hear it. It's very good.
Okay.
So Todd called me one day and he said, I'm doing this record where I'm going to finish songs with other people. Going to co-write with people by doing it that way. Yeah. You have any unfinished songs?
Yeah.
Said, I got, are you kidding?
Yeah.
How many do you want? And he said, well, send me four. I said, okay. I sent him four.
Yeah.
He calls me back eventually and said, okay, I want to work with this one here.
Yeah.
And I had already done the music and the verses of it, didn't even have a title yet. He said, I'm going to do the rest of the, I'll do the choruses and the rest, some more of the music and produce it. And he did, and I loved what he did with it. Because the original song was kind of down. It's, you know, people struggling and that kind of imagery.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, it's kind of a down thing, but I'm going to make it uplifting for you. Yeah. I said, good luck, buddy.
Yeah.
But it's exactly what he did.
Oh, wow.
So I was really so pleased with it. It's great. So it's on his new record.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, it was great talking to you.
You know, you're wonderful.
I appreciate it, man. You too.
Really are. Okay. And I've had a lot of people, fans and friends of mine, say they've listened to you for years.
So oh, yeah.
You're a very popular man.
Well, thank you. And I was honored to talk to you. I was concerned about keeping up because, like, you know, I know there's some deep crimson people. And I always worry about the deep crimson people if I'm going to talk to you. But I think we did all right.
I must have said a million words by now about Frank and King Crimson.
It was all great.
And David,
it was all great. It was all great.
You know, we touched on everything. So
beautiful.
That was great.
Well, thanks, man.
Well, thanks, Mark.
Okay, there you go. Adrian and Jerry Harrison are performing songs from Talking Heads Remain in Light next week at the Wiltern Theater in L.A. Get tickets at thewiltern.net. You can get Adrian's albums at adrianbellew.net. There's a lot of them. Dig in, man. You're never going to hear somebody else that sounds like that. And what an influence he's had. And what an influence has been had on him. All right, look, you guys, hang out for a second. Okay, look. People, on Thursday, Sam Rockwell is back on the show. He was on back in 2016, episode 695. You can go listen to that now for free. It's available in the free feed. Richard Linklater was also on that episode. There was actually a lot for me and Sam to talk about since the last time he was on. He won an Oscar. He was in American Buffalo on Broadway, which I saw. We made The Bad Guys together, a number one box office movie. So it was good reconnecting with Sammy. This week, I'm in Boulder, Colorado at the Boulder Theater on Thursday, September 22nd, and Fort Collins, Colorado at the Lincoln Center on Friday, September 23rd. I'm in Toronto, Ontario at the Queen Elizabeth Theater on September 30th and October 1st. Then I'm in Livermore, California at the Bankhead Theater on October 6th and Carmel by the Sea, California at the Sunset Center on October 7th. I'll be in London, England at the Bloomsbury Theater Saturday and Sunday, October 22nd and 23rd. And I'll be in Dublin, Ireland at Vicker Street Wednesday, October 26th. Then in November and December in Oklahoma City, Dallas, San Antonio, Houston, Long Beach, California, Eugene, Oregon, Bend, Oregon, Asheville, North Carolina, and Nashville, Tennessee. And my HBO special taping at Town Hall in New York City is on Thursday, December 8th. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all dates and ticket info. And before we go, friends, here is some familiar guitar. Monkey and La Fonda, Cat Ames everywhere.